The Right Question is funded by the Steele Reese Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What do you call your story writing style?
I call my style of story writing literary fiction. And I feel that I'm writing in the tradition of Franz Kafka, who wrote very realistically about psychological and emotional states and used a kind of fabulist technique to convey them. So I feel that I'm following in his footsteps or inspired by him, let's put it that way.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Sheree Newman, talking with Cheryl Jaffe about her book titled You Are Not Alone and Other Stories, which won a Spokane Prize for short fiction. Some of the stories in this collection are a little bit spooky, although I didn't think they had a dark tone. But they're a little absurd sometimes, such as the title story, You Are Not Alone, in which a homeless woman lives undiscovered in a man's closet for 2 years. I just have to know where that story came from.
Well, actually, that story came from a news story that I read in the newspaper about a woman in Japan, actually, who lived undetected in a man's closet for 3 years. And when all I had was the bare bones of this story, and it fascinated me and haunted me, so my imagination went into it, and I had a lot of fun with it because I had all these questions like, well, how did she eat? How did she go to the bathroom? How did she bathe? How did she exercise? What did she do? And these are like the Robinson Crusoe questions. How do you survive on an island? And so it was a lot of fun for me to try to imagine how she would, you know, maintain herself by living in a closet. And you don't really know why stories choose you or why you become obsessed with certain stories. And I really didn't know why, but you have to follow them. And later, I felt like the story had a kind of prophetic edge to it because I wrote this story right before my husband died, and he died suddenly. And I felt the story was telling me about how you can be with somebody without being with them, so that the closet door came to be, to me, the line between life and death. So she's watching him, and he doesn't know. And she falls in love with him, and she's looking out for him. And the same way I felt, like, after death, you feel, when somebody dies who you're extremely close with, you feel their presence. And maybe it's wishful thinking, but you imagine that they're looking out for you in some way.
Well, one of your characters, Myrna Herman, earns her living as an emotional detective, a very unusual occupation. Tell us about her.
Well, I think that a writer is a kind of emotional detective because you have to understand your characters from the inside and how their emotions work. So in a sense, Myrna Herman is this stand in for me as a writer, trying to imagine other people's motivations, other people's hearts, and what it's like to be another person. I think that's why we're all attracted to stories, because it gives us an opportunity to inhabit somebody else when we're always locked inside our own heads and our own hearts. And then a story liberates you to be outside of yourself and to understand what it's like to be someone else in a kind of metaphysical way. And I was playing in that story with the genre of the noir detective fiction. So I wanted it to be saturated with heavy emotion. And she has a friend, her best friend, her name is Carolyn Way, who is an Oedipal consultant. And she's completely rational. So I sort of like separated parts of the self, the very rational self and the very emotional self. So I had these two characters talking to each other, which I think goes on in each of us. Our rational side is kind of defeated by our emotional side, and our emotional side is kind of influenced by our rational side. So I'm interested in the difference in the two parts.
Well, as regular listeners to The Right Question know, I love great first lines. And this one certainly got my attention. Quote, "Yes, my wife Marcia and I put a hit on our pets, a 13-year-old purebred golden retriever named Toffee and a 14-year-old black alley cat, our children named Ray." And then if the reader needs more enticement to read on, the second paragraph informs us that the narrator is a rabbi and his wife is, quote, "an extremely decent person." So again, there's got to be a story behind that.
Well, that story is actually about aging and how do we think about aging and death and the quality of life. And I have the main character be a member of the clergy because this is an ethical question. More and more, I think we're deciding, you know, what do we do with the elderly with Alzheimer's? And this story came out of an experience in my own life with my mother-in-law who had Alzheimer's for 15 years and lost all her capacity to know what a spoon was for or what words were. And yet she lived on. And so what is the meaning of great old age when you lose all your capacities? And the story also comes out of my own experience with pets. And I love having pets, but the end game can be horrific with pets. To watch an old dog falling apart and losing everything is horrible. So, and there's always the question of when do you put the dog down? So I wanted to explore the question, okay, well, if the dog is old and incontinent and blind and deaf and everything, is it time to put the dog down, or what is the right thing to do ethically? And I was also interested in the fact that wherever I went with my dog, people would say, "How old is your dog?" I thought, why is this the important question? So I wanted to explore all these questions, and so that's why, you know, I had this absurd idea of putting a hit on the pets. The hit is actually going to the vet and saying, okay, can you put my dog down?
Right. But in this story, he hired someone.
He hires somebody from the mafia to...
A plumber, I think it was.
A plumber. A plumber, right.
Well, the story titled The Open Door seems like a dream, although there's nothing in the story that indicates it's a dream. Am I just putting my own interpretation on that?
Is it a dream or isn't it a dream? On the realistic plane, it seems to be realistic. I mean, it's written as if it's actually happened, where there's a couple and the husband's mother has died and they've sold her house and now they've shipped all her things or a lot of her, like, art objects to her son's house. But he has not had, he wasn't there when she died. And this has haunted him. He has not been able to say goodbye to her. And after somebody dies, there's all these things that belong to the person. So there's a kind of period after somebody dies where they seem to be dead, they're gone, but they're not. I think if you've ever had a loss, people report that there seems to be a period when they're still kind of present. So I thought it would be nice for this man to be able to say goodbye to his mother and to deal with his guilt about having her things, having sold her house. They've sold her house. Well, the house is a symbol of the self. So they've gotten rid of her, you know, in effect. I wanted to deal with all those emotional problems.
And especially in this case, the house was her expression.
She loved
of herself
house.
In the world, yes.
Right.
Very meticulous about decorating. And
she loved her house. But the house is also, always when you see a house in a story, it's the self. It's the person. it's the body.
Ooh, that's so scary. I'm gonna have to think about where I live.
Well, it's just a metaphor.
Yes.
So when you have dreams where you're exploring different rooms in a house that you didn't know were there, that's about, have you ever had such a dream?
I have, many times.
So those dreams are about parts of yourself that you know that there's larger parts of yourself, unknown parts that you're exploring, I think.
Oh, dear. How do you know when something you hear or see or experience is going to become a story?
That is so mysterious. You want to have a story happen to you every day, every minute. You want to be given inspiration, but some things just stick. Like that, when I read that news article about the woman in the closet, I knew that there was something there that I couldn't let go of. And it wasn't for several years that I used that plot for a story, but it's like love, I think. It feels like love. When you fall in love, it's so clear and it's so absolute. The same thing with stories. Like, you get an idea, something sticks to you, and you know that it's going to be a story. And sometimes it's just an idea. I had the luck to have inspiration for a news story, and it came to me after a trip that I took to Boston. And there's something about the trip going east and then coming back west, because I live in San Francisco, and the west in mythology is the land of the dead, you know, in Greek mythology. The phrase came to me, when I died, I was transported east. So then I just followed from there. Sometimes you get something and you know it's going to lead you a place. But it's very mysterious. And if I knew how to bottle inspiration, I would certainly capture it. I don't know. I think you just have to be, if you're alert and you're awake and you're always waiting for it, when it happens, you see it. Just like, when you see when you fall in love the same way, you know it, and you don't expect it, and you don't deserve it. It's lucky. I prefer to write novels. I've also written many novels, because when you're writing a novel, you know, all you need is that one inspiration, and then you can follow it, maybe for years, developing it and exploring it. But with a short story, it's over, and then you don't know when the next one is coming. So it's a little more dangerous working in stories. You can't count on them being there for you. And they're also the place to do risky things.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Cheryl Jaffe about her collection of stories, You Are Not Alone. If you joined us late, no worries. You'll find a link to this program online at therightquestion.blogspot.com. After a short break, Cheryl will read Beauty Secret, one of the stories in the book. Don't go away. Your story, Beauty Secret, is fairly short, so I'd like you to read the whole thing. It's very funny, too.
Okay, well, I'd be happy to read it. For me, finding the form is the very first step to finding the story. If there's a story that wants me to write it, I can't do anything with it until I know what the form would be. And the form needs to be an expression of the content of the story. So the form of this story, which you'll soon hear, is based on days of the week. So it starts on a Wednesday and it ends on a Wednesday. And it's interesting to me that the week goes forward. We go forward through the days and we're going out there, but then we come back, because after 7 days we come back to where we were. So there's some relief in we can't get too far afield. And this story is also about one of my themes, which is what is real. It's a personal quest to figure out what is real in life when something seems real one moment and then something else opposite seems real the next moment, and they both feel exactly real. So the question of reality is, it's a big one. So beauty secret. A lot of women are not sure about their own beauty, and one day they feel beautiful and the next day they don't. And of course, there's what is the reality of that? So this story explores that and what makes you feel beautiful. Okay. Beauty secret. Wednesday. It was Wednesday. Wednesday was Larry's day off. And it was Fern's day off also. This was no accident. They had gone through considerable contortions to get their days off to coincide. Things got pretty ugly when they went without days off together. Wednesday had come none too soon this week because Fern had already begun to feel pretty hideous. She was sitting across from Larry at the kitchen table. "Let's go upstairs," Larry said. He had two wine glasses in one hand and a bottle of wine in the other. Fern knew what he had in mind, the same thing that she had in mind. Why wouldn't she get up from the table? She was too hideous. "Come on," Larry said. Then finally, she followed him up the stairs. Late in the afternoon, before the kids came home from school, Fern got out of bed to start dinner. She caught a glimpse of her naked body in the mirror on her way to the bath. It was ivory and sleek. She was beautiful, she realized with pleasure. Her eyes were dark and bright. Her hair fell to her shoulders in gleaming waves. "You're beautiful," Larry said from the bed. "You made me beautiful when you made love to me," Fern said. "No, I made love to you because you are beautiful," Larry said. Fern went cheerfully down the stairs to make dinner. Thursday. When Fern got up in the morning, she went to the sink to wash her face. She could hear the kids squabbling on their way out the door. Larry was already downstairs making the coffee. She reached for a towel. There was her face in the mirror. It was almost beautiful. She brushed her hair and it fell in almost perfect waves around her shoulders. When she went to her closet, the second outfit she tried on looked pretty good on her. She went downstairs and drank her coffee with Larry. They both read the newspaper. She didn't have quite enough time to finish either before it was time to leave for work. They left the house saying, "I love you," and went in different directions. On the bus, Fern examined the other women. Some of them were almost as attractive as she was. The sky was a near-perfect blue out the bus window. Everything at work went fine. Her colleagues seemed to be looking at her with admiration. Her boss complimented her on her presentation. She stopped at the market on her way home. The cherries were large, firm, and shiny. She tasted one. It was almost bursting with flavor. She brought home a big bag. That night in bed, Fern's legs felt fairly silky. "I'm so in love with you," Larry said, climbing under the covers and turning his backside to her. In a little while, he was breathing peacefully. He was asleep. Friday. When Fern awoke, Larry was already downstairs making the coffee. She could hear the children laughing in the kitchen, and then the front door slam as they left for school. She padded to the sink and splashed water on her face. Were those jowls hanging down below her chin? No, it couldn't be. She went to her closet to choose an outfit. The first one she tried on looked terrible, but the second one was okay. Larry was back in the bedroom shaving. "The Osgoods will be here for dinner tonight," Fern reminded him. "I'll try to behave," Larry said. He came up behind her and cupped her behind. "Get out of here," she said. "I love you," he said, picking up his briefcase. "Love you too," she said. trying to get her hair to do what it always did. It wouldn't. On the bus, there were quite a few women who may have been thinner than she was. Her colleagues at work were a bit irritable. Her boss seemed distracted. She stopped at the market on the way home to get the rest of the produce she needed for her dinner party. The produce was wilted. The Osgoods were boring, and Larry seemed tired. "I just want to finish tidying up," Fern said when they had finally gone. "You go on upstairs." By the time she got upstairs, Larry was asleep. Saturday. They slept late on Saturday morning. Finally, Larry got up to make the coffee, and Fern went to the sink to splash water on her face. She looked in the mirror. Her hair was standing up in every direction. She had jowls, that was clear, and large pouches under her eyes. She went to the closet. The cute little T-shirt she had planned on wearing made her look fat. She heard Larry coming up the stairs with the coffee. She ripped it off and pulled on a sweatshirt. "Good morning, beautiful," he said. The kids were around all day. Finally, they went off with their friends. Larry came and stood over Fern where she was weeding in the garden. "Time for a nap," he said. Fern climbed the stairs behind Larry. She avoided the mirror when they entered the bedroom. They started taking off each other's clothes. Then they heard the front door opening and the kids and their friends pouring back into the house. So they buttoned themselves back up again, and Larry put on the ball game. Fern went to the sink and looked for her lipstick. After applying a thick smudge, she went back out to the garden. She weeded the rest of the day while the kids and their friends played video games in the den. When she got in bed that night, she hoped Larry wasn't expecting anything because she was way too tired. He didn't seem to be. "I love you," he said, giving her a little kiss on the shoulder and turning his back to her back. Sunday. On Sunday, Fern got up first, pulled on Larry's old flannel robe, and went downstairs to make the coffee and get the newspaper. She avoided the mirror, but later, when she was dressing, she hazarded a glance. Her hair was sticking out in all directions. She had jowls, pouches under her eyes, and a roll of fat around her middle. Moreover, her skin had a new pasty look. She pulled on the same sweatshirt as yesterday. There was no point in trying. Larry was getting dressed for his golf game. "I'll be home around 5, beautiful," he said. "Then I'll fire up the barbecue." Fern spent the afternoon at Walmart. The kids played Frisbee late into the evening after the barbecue. There was a great movie on TV that Fern and Larry thoroughly enjoyed, though they both fell asleep before it was over. Monday. Fern spent a long time on Monday morning applying makeup over the red spots that covered her face. She put on a hat to cover her hair and a pair of sunglasses to cover her swollen red eyes. Then she tried on everything in her closet. Everything looked terrible on her. But she was going to be late for work, so she left wearing the last outfit she had tried on, under a big coat, though it was quite warm, leaving all her other clothes in a big pile on the floor of the closet. "I won't be home until late," Larry said, as she passed through the kitchen. "Board meeting. Wait up for me, okay?" He put his hand on her breast. "I'm late," she said. "I love you," he said. "How do I look?" she said. "Fantastic," he said. "I could jump you right now." "Hold that thought," she said, and went out the door. She was by far the most hideous woman on the bus. At the office, her colleagues looked at her with pity. Or was it disgust? Her work was inferior, meaningless, and boring. Finally, they allowed her to leave. She got some takeout on the way home. The kids were overjoyed. She took a long bath and avoided all mirrors. She fell asleep before Larry got home. Tuesday. When Fern got up Tuesday and looked in the mirror, she noticed that her teeth had yellowed overnight. New fine lines had formed around her eyes. Her jowls now had jowls. And where had her chin gone? As she raised her arm to brush her hair, the skin on her upper arm flapped back and forth. Her thighs jiggled as she walked across the floor to get her underwear. She heard Larry coming up the stairs with the coffee and jumped into the closet. She pulled out a sack-like dress from the pile on the floor and pulled it over her head. She couldn't bear the idea of struggling with pantyhose, so she put on some knee-highs and hoped the tops wouldn't show when she sat down. "Why are you wearing that big coat? It's 90 degrees outside," Larry said, as she skirted around him and went for the door. "Stop criticizing me. You don't have any right to criticize me." "I wasn't criticizing you," Larry said. "I just think it's awfully hot for a big coat like that." "You're doing it again," Fern said. "Just stop." "I wasn't doing anything," Larry said. "Just stop it," Fern said. "Why won't you stop?" On the bus, Fern silently dared people to look at her. She stared at them until they looked away. What was the matter with them? Hadn't they ever seen a hideously ugly woman before? At work, Fern hid in her office most of the day, pretending to go over reports, but she couldn't focus on anything. When everyone went to lunch, she didn't go with them. When she got home at night, the kids were in the kitchen. "What's for dinner?" they asked. "Eat whatever you want," Fern said. "I'm not making dinner. I'm off duty tonight." They were already taking out the Cheerios as she left the kitchen. Larry was just coming in the door. "I'm going to bed," she said to him. "Okay," he said. "I can fend for myself. Are you okay?" "I'm fine, just fine," Fern said, climbing the stairs. She didn't turn on the light when she entered the bedroom. She was afraid of the mirrors. When Larry got in bed next to her, she pretended to be asleep. Wednesday. Wednesday came none too soon this week. Fern was feeling pretty hideous. She was sitting across from Larry at the kitchen table. "Let's go upstairs," Larry said. He had two wine glasses in one hand and a bottle of wine in the other. Fern knew what he had in mind, the same thing that she had in mind. Why wouldn't she get up from the table? She was too hideous. "Come on," Larry said. Then finally she followed him up the stairs. Late in the afternoon, before the kids came home from school, Fern got out of bed to start dinner. She caught a glimpse of her naked body in the mirror on her way to the bath. It was ivory and sleek. She was beautiful, she realized with pleasure. Her eyes were dark and bright, and her hair fell to her shoulders in gleaming waves. I realized with that story that there's certain details in there that are totally unfamiliar to me, like barbecues and golf games and video games. And it was fun for me to have characters who have these things in their lives. So that was another pleasure for me. But the other thing about that story is, how can we have the confidence to believe in ourselves, whether in our beauty or our inherent value as people? And I think the answer in this story is that when we're loved, that love makes everything possible. It empowers us, yes. And it's very hard without it to know what reality is.
Cheryl Jaffe is the Penn Award-winning author of 10 books. She's also a professor of creative writing and literature at Sonoma State University and lives in San Francisco. Find out more about her at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Also there, poetry, book reviews, and links to our podcast and Facebook page.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau, Lisa Simon, David Moore, and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Osteen, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to author information, audio, and our Facebook and podcast feeds at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.